Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. It's been over a month since the federal government was last fully opened. In the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, nearly 800,000 federal employees are either furloughed or working without pay. And if the shutdown continues through the end of this week, federal district courts will run out of funds and federal employees will miss their second paycheck. The stakes are high, and the federal government is still struggling to reach a compromise. Over the weekend, President Trump proposed a deal that would provide temporary protection for DACA and temporary protected status, or TPS, recipients in exchange for more than $5 billion for a border wall and enhanced enforcement.
That is our plan. Border security, DACA, TPS, and many other things. Straightforward, fair, reasonable, and common sense. With lots of compromise.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would put the plan up for a vote this week. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has already called the proposal a, quote, non-starter. Her party is insisting the president reopen the government before any border security compromise is reached. In the meantime, Americans are still struggling to get by. Joining us to help us make sense of all this is Emily Cochran, a congressional reporter for The New York Times. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this negotiation, if we can even call it a negotiation, that happened over the weekend, the president put forth his plan. The response was predictable from the Democrats. Is there any movement towards a compromise at this point?
That remains to be seen this week when lawmakers return to vote. But the plan was intended by Republicans as sort of an outreach to Democrats as a hope to getting some more moderates to maybe break from the party line. But so far, Democrats have pretty roundly criticized the plan. While the offer does extend protections to the Dreamers and TPS recipients, the president was the one who revoked those protections in the first place. So the offer isn't as appealing to them as some Republicans may have hoped.
I was going to say, it felt like the president was giving us something that was sort of already there and was just putting it back on the table.
That's definitely how many Democrats took it. And their argument remains that the government should be reopened before there's any kind of negotiation on border security.
Wondering also, what are the Democrats doing as a result? Are they sweetening the deal? I mean, they've added $1 billion of border-related spending to their part of the deal. What is the holdup there? Why was that not appealing to the president?
You're right. Speaker Pelosi intends to bring up her own legislation that includes an additional $1 billion for border security. It would have money for 75 new immigration judges and support staff. But without a border wall, without his ability to fulfill that concrete campaign promise that he spent the midterm elections touting across the country, the president isn't comfortable caving to that.
You know, I feel like one thing is to keep a campaign promise. Another thing is to essentially furlough, 800,000 people to fulfill something that right now it appears that the majority of the American public does not support. How does the party reconcile that?
It's true that broadly the border wall remains unpopular, but it appears that support among Republican voters, among the president's base, who for him are some of the most important voters out there, support for the wall among those people has hardened. There are several people who are saying, we want to see the wall. It's okay to keep the government shut down until you get that. It's a continuation of this ongoing debate where Republicans say, we need to have a border wall before the government is reopened. Democrats say we'll consider increased border security, not necessarily a wall, but increased border security if you reopen the government. Both sides are looking to the other to blink first. And 30 days in, it's still unclear who's going to make that first move.
We're also seeing TSA workers are continuing to call out. Do you expect that at some point, if this is not resolved, that we'll begin to see, we've seen a couple of federal lawsuits filed against the government because of shutting it down. Do you think that's going to increase?
Yes, I think we're going to continue to see everything we've seen over the last 30 days it's just going to continue to build up and build up, and more people will continue to not come into work. There are other people who work for the government who will continue to try to find other means of income so they can continue to have a livelihood while the government is shut down. I think you're just going to see more and more of those stories as people try to figure out how to survive a shutdown that some people expected to happen, but did not expect to happen for this long. And it is only 25% of the government that shut down, yet we see so many widespread effects just from those handful of agencies.
Emily Cochran is a congressional reporter for the New York Times. Emily, thanks again.
Thank you.
Last Thursday, the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General released a report saying thousands of children may have been separated from their families before the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy went into effect. In addition, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley released a leaked document created by officials from the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department. That document showed that the Trump administration considered family separation as early as 2017, months before the zero-tolerance policy was announced. According to these new documents, federal officials also considered plans including denying separated children their legal right to asylum hearings in order to speed up the deportation process. These developments contradict what the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has said. In June 2018, she tweeted, quote, "We do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period." She told Congress the same last month. Joining us from Oregon to tell us more is Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, Tanzina. Good to be with you.
So first, Senator, DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testified before the House Judiciary Committee in December, and I want to play this exchange between her and Representative Luis Gutierrez from Illinois.
Shame on us for wearing our badge of Christianity during Christmas and allow the secretary to come here and lie.
Time of the gentleman has expired. If the secretary would care to respond to any of that.
Only then to say that calling me a liar are fighting words. I'm not a liar. We've never had a policy for family separation. I'm happy to walk the gentleman through it again.
Senator, the document that your office has received says otherwise. Can we please clarify, did the administration have a policy of separating children? And when did this first start, as far as you understand?
Absolutely, they had such a policy. The planning for it began very early in the administration. In fact, John Kelly, who at that point was head of the Department of Homeland Security, spoke about it in March 2017, saying that they were very strongly considering a strategy of child separation. Fast forward to December, when this document comes from. It's a very detailed planning document from high up in Homeland Security and the Attorney General's office, working out the nuances of the policy options. When Jeff Sessions announces the policy in May 2018, he talks about child separation. In June, I go down to the border and see the children in cages, having been separated from their parents. So it wasn't just a policy option, it was a policy implemented. And so it's so disturbing to me to have the administration officials stand up, and actually in that December quote, she was under oath, and say that there was no such policy. We know the account was detailed, maybe 2,700 children during the period that was formally documented. And as you pointed out, perhaps thousands more before that. We had heard that the administration was running a pilot project as early as March to mid-2017 of child separation. Workers in the field started to hear about it, and they started asking the administration. The administration said, no, that's not happening. It's an egregious crime against children as part of a strategy of sending a message, quote, of deterrence, which has in some form or another been repeated again and again. In other words, we will hurt children in order to implement a political strategy to deter families from seeking asylum in the United States of America.
Senator,
that is just deeply wrong.
Senator, on Friday, you called on the FBI to investigate Secretary Nielsen for perjury. Are there any developments on that call?
So I've not heard back from the FBI. This is the official way laid out for Congress to initiate an investigation into whether an individual who has testified before Congress has lied. And I just come from the viewpoint of I am sick and tired of the administration officials lying to Congress. And so I hope that the FBI will take action. I have my doubts that under this administration they would jump in and say, yes, we take this sort of thing seriously, but I hope they will.
I want to also ask about the Inspector General report. The citing there is it's unspecific in how many family separations took place, but what they are citing is that thousands of children from the report may have been separated from their families before zero tolerance took place. Was Congress aware of this, Senator?
So I had heard rumors that the administration was pursuing this with a pilot project somewhere in that range of time. Other people asked the administration about it. They absolutely denied it. So basically the answer is no. There was some sense that something new was going on that they weren't quite being forthcoming about, but the answer is no. There was no hard evidence or report or briefing of Congress about what they were doing.
We're still hearing reports of family separations along the U.S.-Mexico border. We're hearing them from immigration attorneys. We're hearing from fellow journalists. What is the expected oversight going to be moving forward with this issue?
Well, we're going to have a lot of oversight from the House of Representatives under the Republican leadership of the House and Senate. There has been no interest in exercising oversight. I think most of America is completely revulsed by the idea of a policy targeting children, and of course the experts have told us how much trauma, long-term damage this does to children, and yet no oversight from the House or Senate until now. And the Democratic-led House is going to look at this very closely and try to get to the bottom of it.
Of course, as you know, Senator, in June of 2018, last year, a federal judge did order the federal government to halt the separations at the border and to reunite children with their parents. Why has this continued? We've got about a minute left, Senator.
We have a variety of cases that may be legitimate in terms of a criminal background of the parent, but we also see the administration proceeding to pursue family incarceration. And they have two family internment camps that I visited in Texas. That's a terrible thing. They have built a system with mid-December 15,000 children in child prisons across America, migrant children in prisons. So the damage to children is much broader than just the child separation.
Jeff Merkley is a Democratic senator from Oregon. Senator Merkley, thanks for your time.
You are very welcome. Thanks so much.
For 80 years, a bronze statue of 19th century Dr. James Marion Sims stood in New York City's Central Park. Sims's major achievement was developing a technique to repair painful fistulas, or tears, that resulted from childbirth, often between the birth canal and the urethra or rectum. He has often been called the father of modern gynecology. But public outrage about how Sims did that work, by experimenting on enslaved black women, forced New York City officials to finally remove the statue in 2018.
I would love it if there were a representation of the women that felt as striking as that statue of Sims.
That's playwright Charlie Yvonne Simpson, whose new play, Behind the Sheet, reckons with Sims's legacy and the black women who had to suffer for it.
I think something that was extremely important to me in the play and in sort of looking at this history is acknowledging what the women went through.
We should get you moving. Master George won't like that you're still here and not resting. He'll want you rested before he tries.
Tries?
Well, all he did today was remove some of the rotten parts of you.
No parts of me are rotten.
I just mean the parts of you beyond fixing, the parts of you that have already died. He had to clear those away, and then once you heal, he can try to close the hole.
We had a group of black women, we know three of their names, but there were more, who went through these surgeries, and it was painful. And pain was a part of their lives, whether or not they were being operated on. So even when they were off the table, pain was going to be a huge part of their lives.
In her research, Simpson found that both plantation owners and the scientific community took advantage of the experimentation Sims performed on enslaved Black women.
You had these plantation owners who had ended up with these women, these slaves, who had this issue. You know, Black women during that time were breeders. That was part of, you know, our quote-unquote usefulness. And so suddenly you now had these women who were in constant pain, who are not in a position to have children, and maybe not even in a position to do all the work that they used to do. And so these plantation owners found their way to Dr. Sims, being one of them, being like, you know, what is going on? How can we fix this? He sort of discovered that he could get a really good look inside of a woman and thus at fistulas if he sort of fashioned a tool to look in. And so that's actually how we get the speculum. And so that's sort of how we begin these years of experimentation.
Experimentation that the women on his operating table could not consent to.
Here's my thing. You are talking about women who were enslaved. And being enslaved means you are the property of someone else. That means that you do not own your own body, your own self. So the idea of consent in a world where these women, you know, weren't even really considered fully human seems a little bit ridiculous to me.
How many times he tried on you?
A few.
You ain't fixed yet?
Not yet.
So he can't do it?
You were helping him get there.
What if I don't want to help him?
When's the last time anything that we wanted mattered for anything? Besides, he bought you. You're his now.
Simpson says we still don't know all of the details of Sims' story and his methods.
What we do know is that he did not use anesthesia on these women and really didn't believe the pain was big enough for anesthesia to be used.
That's despite the emerging use of anesthesia in the mid-19th century, particularly by the end of Sims' experimentation.
Well, how many surgeries has she had?
15 about.
And how many on you? I feel like you in there every other week.
You can't be in there every other week.
Feels like it.
I just tend to heal up faster than the others.
So
it has been quite a few times. He says I'm a better candidate than some of the others. Shouldn't you be getting off to bed, Louis?
Yes. How many times?
I've lost count.
Philomena.
20. 25. I don't know. 28. I'll be going in for 29 soon enough. The lead sutures didn't take.
But in crafting the story, Simpson said there had to be more than just suffering.
I was not and continue to not be interested in, you know, re-traumatizing us and having us, you know, having the only takeaway be pain. You know, I was interested in showing these women's humanity. And part of humanity is fighting to find joy sometimes. It's fighting with each other. It's pushing back. It's making perfume, as they do in the play. Yeah, so that felt really, really important to include. If I was going to include Black pain, to make sure that I was including Black joy.
It's a similar duality that Simpson grapples with when she tells Sims' story in Behind the Sheet.
I don't hate Sims. I think that J. Marion Sims, like many other doctors and scientists and just people at the time, lived within an evil system, which we call slavery, that put certain people, white people, above Black people and took away Black people's humanity. And that is terrible and that is evil. And I hate that. That said, I also acknowledge the fact that Sims's work was important. Figuring out how to close fistulas helped not only Black women, it did help white women and other women throughout the United States and throughout the world, quite frankly, you know, even as the procedure may have been refined. And his work, you know, led to him opening a women's hospital here in New York City. And, you know, he's called the father of modern gynecology for a reason. I go to the gynecologist, they use a speculum. Mm-hmm. You know, I can appreciate that. But I think it is important for me, and I hope for anyone sort of seeing the play, to hold both of those things, to hold the good that he did and hold the bad way that he did it, and somehow learn to honor both sides of that.
After New York City removed the Sims statue in Central Park in 2018, one local preservation group suggested that a good replacement might be Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler, the first African-American woman physician in the United States. So far, it hasn't been replaced. Charlie Yvonne Simpson is a playwright whose new play, Behind the Sheet, is on stage now in New York City. Our thanks to Christy Taylor, SciArts producer for Science Friday, who conducted the interview with Charlie Yvonne Simpson. The Supreme Court has ruled that the Trump administration's military ban on transgender Americans can go into effect, while lawsuits against the policy continue to play out across the country. The ban had been blocked by multiple injunctions issued in lower courts. In a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court justices lifted those injunctions. President Trump announced that he was barring transgender individuals from service in July 2017, writing then that the military, quote, cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. I'm now joined by Paula Neera, a Navy veteran, attorney, and a registered nurse, who is also the programming director at the Johns Hopkins Center for Transgender Health. Paula, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you are a veteran. You've served in the Navy before you came out as trans. As someone who has served in the armed forces, what was your reaction to the ruling today?
I was very discouraged by the Supreme Court action. I think that the district courts got it right, but it's not the end of the fight. Those cases are now going to work their way through the judicial process, and eventually we'll have a decision on the merits.
As we mentioned in the introduction, when President Trump first announced this ban, he gave a number of reasons for it. One of them was tweeting that allowing transgender people to serve in the military, and this is the president speaking, would result in, quote, tremendous medical costs and disruption. What do you make of that statement?
It was either woefully ignorant or intentionally intellectually dishonest, is because the bases aren't grounded in reality. The cost of providing the medical care is inconsequential. About $8.4 million a year is what the RAND study said. Yet, you know, it'll cost approximately $960 million to replace the transgender military people that are serving. And every one of the senior uniformed officers have said that since transgender people have been able to serve openly, there's been no disruption in the force. So the two rationales that were given by the administration aren't grounded in evidence and experience.
If you're somebody today who is in the military, who's serving openly as a transgender person, what happens to you today?
Well, it depends on where you're at. Is if you have come out to your command and you are serving, you are going to continue to serve. And I think that's one thing that the listeners need to understand is that the thousands of transgender troops in the force today are going to get up tomorrow and they're going to do their duty and they're going to do it well and they're going to do it in every branch of the service, including forward deployed and in combat operations, just like they've done for the last 2.5 years. There's a lot of uncertainty for an individual once the Department of Defense actually implements the policy, because that hasn't happened yet, is they need to put an effective date on their policy and actually begin implementing it. If someone who has not come out by that point comes out after that point, then it could be the end of their naval career or their military career, which would force people to serve in the closet.
Which we've seen this happen before. This is definitely something that's part of the military's past in this country, serving in the closet. And in fact, a Military Times poll from October 2017 found that a little more than half, that's 53% of active duty troops, said they support the ban on transgender people serving in the military. How do you take those numbers, Paula? Do they surprise you at all?
They don't surprise me because people are making statements based off of a lack of information and they're operating off of their own either implicit or explicit bias because of what they think they know about transgender people. And if you looked at polls, most of the troops who were serving in the 1940s didn't want to serve in an integrated military. Most of the troops didn't want to serve with women. Most of the troops didn't want to serve with gay, lesbian, or bisexual folks. So there's a history of polls that say we don't want to serve with their kind. Yet every time that we've expanded the ability for people to serve our country, the military's gotten stronger.
Paula, what are you watching for next as this unfolds?
Waiting to see the court cases progress, because none of them have gone to the actual trial stage. And also waiting to see what the Department of Defense does about taking any steps to actually implement the new policy.
Well, we'll be paying close attention. Paula Neera is a Navy veteran. Paula, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In March 2016, the city of Newark, New Jersey, announced that elevated levels of lead had been found in 30 schools across the city. Newark Mayor Roz Baraka was quick to downplay the threat.
Water in Newark is safe and drinkable. That's important for folks to know. But here, the water system in Newark is still safe, is still drinkable.
The city stuck with that message even through 2017 as residential water testing revealed levels of lead that were high enough to prompt a federal intervention. A new round of testing conducted last year showed elevated lead levels in nearly half of the houses monitored. But a month later, the mayor doubled down on his claims about the water safety.
There's nothing wrong with Newark's water source. And that's all we've been saying, that there's nothing wrong with Newark's water source. Nothing. And the problem is that they're trying to create this hysteria, which I think is terrible. It's like yelling fire in a crowded movie theater.
But tests conducted this month show that the lead levels in the city's water are the highest they've been in 17 years. In response, Mayor Baraka took to the internet, where he criticized President Trump's focus on the southern border and instead urged the White House to help the people of Newark. He called the situation a crisis and a true emergency. Karen Yee is a staff reporter for the Star-Ledger and NJ.com, and she's been covering this story from the beginning, and she joins us now. Karen, hi.
Hi, good to be here.
So lots of back and forth here. We have Mayor Roz Baraka saying, the water's fine, and all of a sudden we have a crisis. What happened?
So what changed was the mayor said initially he believed it was a limited problem, that a few old homes had elevated lead levels. But in October, after the city commissioned a study to look at its water treatment plant, they found that the way they were treating the water was no longer effective. So essentially, the water going through the pipes was corrosive, and it was causing the lead in these old pipes to leach into the water and then go through the faucet. And so that's when he acknowledged that the lead crisis in the city was a bit wider and a bit broader than he had previously said.
Why did it take him so long to get to that point?
So the mayor has said that they wanted to study the issue before inciting hysteria that this was a widespread problem. And in October, that's when the engineering group that did the study, that's when they released their draft report and released those findings.
So what is actually happening with the lead in the water in Newark? Is this something that has affected residents yet? I hear this story and I think about Flint, Michigan.
Yes. So the mayor has insisted time and time again that this is not like Flint. There are some clear differences between Flint and Newark. In Flint, the city changed its water source and they had no corrosion control treatment. And that's when you treat the water to make it less corrosive. Newark has had the same source water and does have corrosion control treatment. But the difference is that the corrosion control treatment stopped working at some point. And so what we're seeing now is Newark has two water treatment facilities. One of those has had its corrosion control no longer work, which means that about 40,000 residents and about 18,000 homes are affected.
So the crisis first became public in 2016, which was, as we mentioned, after Flint, Michigan had its own crisis. I want to play a clip from Mayor Roz Baraka one more time from November.
I think the water thing is sexy and everybody has jumped on it because of Flint. Water has not contributed in any significant way to the elevated lead levels in our children's blood. Lead-based paint and dust has done that.
Is that correct?
It's really hard to tell what has contributed to elevated lead levels in children's blood. We do know that recent results have shown a spike in the number of kids in Newark that have elevated blood lead levels. In 2017, the number was 5.9% compared to 5.3% the year prior. And this is in children 6 years to 26 months old. So the people who put together the report, the Advocates for Children of New Jersey, said it's really hard to tell whether that's airborne lead, lead from dust and paint, lead coming from their pipes. It's hard to track that down, but we do know that there's been an increase.
We should also say that the people who are being affected by this are largely low-income, black and brown Newark residents. Is that right?
Right. And that's where some of the comparisons to Flint come in, because Flint was similarly high poverty and predominantly a black city.
The Natural Resources Defense Council did file a lawsuit against Newark last year for what they claim was a violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. I'm going to play you a comment that we got from Eric Olson, who's the senior director of that organization for health and food.
Unfortunately, for well over a year, there was just outright denial that there was a lead contamination problem that made any difference. With repeated statements that the water was totally safe and people should drink it. And we're pleased that that message has now changed and that they're acknowledging that there is a serious problem with the water supply in Newark. The bottom line is that kids across the city of Newark are having their health put at risk by lead contamination in their water.
What happens now, Karen, with this lawsuit, with the acknowledgement by Mayor Roz Baraka that this is an issue? What happens now?
Right now, the city is in the middle of trying to make fixes. So they're trying to fix its water treatment process. That's going to take a long time. It's not an overnight fix. It's going to take about 8 months. In the meantime, the city is distributing about 40,000 filters to residents. 25,000 of those filters have been distributed so far. And they're also in the process of changing those lead service lines. And that's going to take at least 8 years. It's going to cost $75 million. And that's what the mayor was asking for help from the federal government.
Has the federal government responded?
Last time I checked, they have not responded to the city.
What about the residents of Newark? Are they aware that this is a problem? What has their response been?
It's definitely been a growing awareness, I would say. When we started covering the issue in spring of last year, a lot of residents weren't aware. It wasn't until this national group came in and national media came in that residents started waking up to the notion that there is something wrong with the water and that maybe their children could be at risk. So I think people are starting to gain awareness and also frustration, I think, with the messaging that they are hearing from the city that the water was safe to drink when in reality it wasn't safe in all of the homes.
Are there any residents who are planning to any legal action as a result of that we know of?
Some of the local residents are actually part of the federal lawsuit filed by the Natural Resources Defense Council, but I'm not aware of any additional legal cases.
And has the mayor, Roz Baraka, decided what their next steps are? Are they going to petition the federal government again?
At this point, I'm not sure. The federal case from the Natural Resources Defense Council is ongoing. The city has made a motion to dismiss that case, and that motion is pending.
Karen Yee is a staff reporter for the Star-Ledger, NNJ.com. Karen, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And we did reach out to Mayor Roz Baraka for comment on this story and are hoping to speak with him on our show this week. And that's our show for today. You can always find us on Facebook and leave us a comment there. You can follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. Give us a call about anything at 877-8MYTAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway. You can tweet me at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.